Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save, with customised coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh, yeah, nice, the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Once again, a very big shout out to Jay Group, the author of both of tonight's stories. Hey, welcome back, everyone, to the channel. Tonight's video, we have two horrifying stories I'm going to be sharing with you tonight. Both are involving Canadians. What is going on up there? Tell me. Anyways, first is about a married couple that go on a retreat to their cottage in the mountains. But unfortunately, they were not alone. And then second, we have this kid where his snowmobile stops working and gets frozen up because he flooded the engine. And he's stuck out there for several days. But again, he is not alone. Stay tuned. If you're new to the channel, subscribe. Click on that bell and smash that thumbs up and tell a friend. It was late at night, and we were driving up to the family cottage when the first police car came up behind us on the highway. My wife didn't see it at first, and she made a surprised noise before pulling over to the side of the single-lane highway. We closely came to a stop on the gravel shoulder, and the cop car sped past us, the Airstream buffeting us to the side. It was going very fast, I thought, even for a cop car with its lights and siren on. After a few moments, my wife pulled back onto the road. It was odd to see a police car, or any vehicle for that matter, this late at night on Highway 7. It was 3 a.m., and that had been the first car we had seen for a while. After driving for a few more minutes, she exclaimed again and pulled over quickly. This time, nearly a dozen police cars drove past. We watched them go in astonishment. What on earth would be going on to cause such a response? We lived in Canada, so murders and gun crimes are uncommon. My first thought was an arson or perhaps a drug bust. But that didn't seem right for the amount of cars and the time of night. The thought of a murderer on the loose didn't even cross my mind, not at the time. We kept driving and she pulled over three more times to let police cars go by. Each time, more than a few cops sped past at high speeds. All told, about 30 of the squad cars went by before we saw the last of them. The stereo had nothing but static for the most part, and Twitter was silent on the subject when I used my intermittent data service on my phone to check for police news in the area. It was a small community, so the local police department didn't even have a Twitter account, I noticed. By the time we got to the cottage, we were both exhausted. As I described here before, our family cabin is a long way off the beaten path. We're at the end of an isolated peninsula on a small lake. It takes 30 minutes of driving down treacherous back roads, some of which barely qualify as roads, to reach the quaint little shack. And that's after the 4-hour drive on freeways and single-lane highways just to get into the area. The place was so dilapidated, we told people we were going camping when we were up there, even though it was technically a cottage. We pulled into the driveway, which was just a couple of tire racks in the grass. I got out of the car and swatted at mosquitoes as I pulled out my phone and turned on the flashlight app. The lake was still and quiet, with only the sound of crickets and bullfrogs and the odd coyote howl in the distance. It would be another couple of hours before the birds began to sing, and the bass began to jump out of the water, making unexpected splashing noises. I went up to the rickety wooden stairs to the front door and put the key into the lock, turning it with an effort, making the mental note to put a bit of lubricant on it before the end of the weekend. Stepping inside, I bulked as I felt cobwebs on my face and felt something crawling on the back of my neck. I yelped and brushed the thing off of me, feeling a spider bite on the back of my neck before I could get to it with my hand. I made a pain noise and said a quick prayer to Jesus, asking him to prevent infection and or give me Spider-Man abilities. I heard something move in the darkness of the cabin. We had mice, so at first I dismissed it as that. But then I took a second longer to process the sound. It had sounded larger than a mouse, whatever it was.
Hello?
I called into the cabin, my voice quivering. No one answered. I was worried momentarily that a raccoon had found its way in. It was possible, especially now that I noticed a draft coming in from the back room. Maybe a window had been broken from a fallen tree branch, allowing wildlife inside, I thought. There was no electricity in the cabin, since I hadn't hooked up the marine battery to the inverter yet. I used the light on my phone as I walked in further, taking slow and tentative steps. My heart beat loud and fast in my ears. My mouth and throat felt dry, and my stomach felt fluttery and strange.
Hello?
I said again, still sensing another presence inside. Something with eyes watching me, waiting. I proceeded further and almost released the contents of my overfilled bladder into my pants, when someone put their forearm around my neck tightly, choking me. I felt a cold, steel blade dig into the flesh below my ear and a sting as it prodded past the superficial skin, drawing blood. Warmth trickled down the side of my neck and turned cold in the chilly night air.
Not a sound.
The voice behind me was not asking. It was a raspy-sounding man, his smoker's voice totally devoid of emotion.
Not a sound or I will frickin' kill you. Tell your bitch to come inside.
My wife came in, saying something about how tired she was, and then dropped what she was carrying and screamed. She stood frozen in the doorway, mosquitoes flying in past her, the car headlights making her into a silhouette, a caricature of a scared person. Her hands were up at her sides of her face and her legs shook. She tried to say something but stammered and stopped.
I'm gonna take your car, the man said. Give me the keys.
I looked at my wife and tried to tell her to give the man the keys, but my voice didn't work. Another person was in the room, I noticed suddenly. There was a young teenage girl in the shadows, behind the couch on the floor. She rocked back and forth silently in the darkness. The knife dug further into my neck and I cried out in pain.
The keys, he said again.
They're in the car,
my wife said, her voice just above a whisper.
Your phones, he said, again, not a question.
I handed my phone to him, my only source of light. There were flashlights scattered around the cabin, but the batteries inside would be questionable at best. We would be left in utter blackness without a car, but that was the least of our concerns at the moment. My wife put her phone on the ground and kicked it over to him after he told her to do so. He told her to move away from the door.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
And she came inside and stood in the kitchen. Now we were at an impasse. He would have to let me go if he wanted to take the girl with him, the one crying in the corner. I felt a wave of sorrow for her, knowing the feeling of just 1 minute at the mercy of this terrible man. His voice was inhuman, monstrous. He took the knife away from the side of my neck quickly and stabbed it into my thigh up to the hilt. I screamed and fell to the floor, writhing in pain and rolling back and forth. The agony was so intense I couldn't catch my breath, and I felt for a moment I would lose consciousness. I stayed awake, though, and felt fresh pain as the man reached down and pulled the knife out of my leg. Blood spurted high into the air and all over his face, drenching him in my blood. He laughed and looked down at me, his face crimson red and dripping, except for the whites in his eyes and his smiling teeth. He wiped the blade of the knife on his shirt, carefully, methodically. He didn't think about my wife still behind him. He had called her a bitch. But he didn't know what a badass she actually was. My wife had been taking a lot of classes since our run-in with the locals our last time upon the cottage. She wanted to be prepared if we ran into trouble again here, and had become obsessed with self-defense and jujitsu in particular. She had previously obtained a purple belt in BJJ, but was now even more dedicated, quickly progressing to the black belt in record time. She jumped up in the air and managed to get her right leg over his arm, the one that held the knife. The flying armbar is a difficult maneuver to pull off, especially against a taller opponent, but she had been practicing like it was a full-time job. I had spent many nights as her practice dummy. She wrapped her arms around the man's wrist and yanked backwards with her body weight. She had been working out, and managed to break his arm with a loud snap. I'm sure the adrenaline pumping through her veins helped maximize her torque, as I had never seen her so successful against a larger opponent. She had also caught him completely by surprise. I heard more bones crack as she pulled back even further, not relenting as just one broken bone. The man screamed and howled as his ulna and radius broke into multiple places. His shoulder popped out of socket farther and farther. I heard another loud snap, his humerus maybe. I thought we had him beat then. But just as he had been caught by surprise, so were we. The girl who I thought was his prisoner suddenly appeared behind my wife and pulled her off the man, screaming and swiping at her. She had a knife as well, I saw with alarm. It was smaller, but she had a grip tight in her fist. The light casted by my cell phone, which laid haphazardly on the floor, illuminating the scene at times, but it was mostly shrouded by darkness. I couldn't see what was happening as I held tight pressure on my wound. I pulled off my shirt and wrapped it around my leg as a tourniquet, trying to make a futile effort to ignore my blood loss and get up to help. The man was no longer writhing on the floor. He had a furious look in his face, and his arm hung limp at his side. I was suddenly terrified as I watched him get up to his knees shakily and try to stand. He fell once, face planted with a loud smack into the wooden floor. It seemed not to affect him, though, as he just got back up to one knee again. Then I saw in the dim light what he was reaching for. His knife was laying on the floor, just out of reach. He was trying to crawl over to it. In the darkness, I heard the two women fighting. It was starting to sound like my wife was getting the better of the young girl, who was fighting like a wild woman. She had been screaming and sticking her with the tiny knife again and again, but was beginning to lose steam and slow down, her arms suddenly heavy and tired. My wife finally got a hold of her and twisted it backwards, dislocating the young girl's shoulder. She fell to the floor in a heap, holding her arm and making hurt animal-like noises. The man was just about to reach the knife, I realized. I shouted to my wife and told her to look out. She saw, but just a moment too late. She was going to try to kick the man in the chin as he reached for the knife, but he saw her at the last second and pulled away. She slipped on the floor, which was slick with far too much blood, as her foot missed his face, and the force of her kick lifted her off her feet. She fell down hard on her shoulders and neck, but didn't stay down for long. She got up covered in blood and tried to avoid the man as he slashed at her with the knife. My wife backed up into the kitchen counter and felt around behind her for a weapon. She found one. The man came at her and lunged. She sidestepped out of the way and he went past her, flying all his body weight into the kitchen counter. He looked like he had the wind knocked out of him and was stunned for a moment. That's when my wife hit him in the back of the head with the frying pan, hard. He collapsed to the floor and the girl ran over to him, screaming at us. I managed to get to my knee and grabbed my phone. I held it in the girl's eyes, blinding her with the bright light. She covered her face and cursed at me, her voice pure rage. She cradled her arm, looking defiant despite her injuries. I picked up the knife the man had dropped and managed to get onto one leg. I held on to the wall for support and told my wife we needed to go now. She agreed and we limped out of there together. We got into the car and drove away, hearing the girl's insane voice from behind us, calling after us menacingly.
We're going to find you, you know. Don't think you've won, because you ain't won shit. He's gonna wake up and guess what? We're gonna come for you next. You ain't beat us. You ain't shit, you mother effers. You're gonna frickin' die. You're gonna frickin' die, you hear me?
We found out the next day when we read the paper just what had happened. The man was a cannibalistic serial killer, and the girl was his brainwashed accomplice, an underaged protege. The authorities had found human remains from multiple victims buried in his backyard, and had initiated a manhunt for him after he had disappeared. That's why all the cop cars had passed us on the highway on the way to the cottage. It was just our luck he had picked our isolated cabin at the end of the peninsula, far away from prying eyes. The chances were 1 in a million, conservatively. He had been hiding there for just a few hours when we stumbled upon him. The worst part is, I know he's not dead, and he hasn't been caught. We called the police, but they managed to get away before they could get there. They are both trained hunters and survivalists. I've found out since, so they know how to get by in the wild. I only hope the police managed to catch them before they could find us. I'm worried because I know there's a million things in the cabin that could have identified us. A fire permit which bore my mother's name hung from a board in the living room. The police said it wasn't there when they checked the cabin. I've got a new security system and additional locks on my doors, but I don't know if we could prevent the inevitable. It might be time that I started taking jiu-jitsu classes with my wife. All right. So when I was a teenager back in Labrador, I got stranded out in the snow. I was out there feeding our sled dogs, since we kept them on an island when they weren't in service. My snowmobile broke down, and I tried to restart it and flooded the engine. I spent 2 hours trying to start it again, but then gave up and realized it was hopeless. The thing was frozen solid. It was that cold. I ended up out there for 2 nights. When I realized the first night the sun was going down that I was going to be stranded out there, I remembered my uncle's advice. He told me to start by making a shelter. So I dug out into the snow, about 2 or 3 feet, and made a cave. Then I grabbed some pine boughs and laid those down inside to keep it warm for the night, somehow. What did I eat? Nothing. I was starving. There was nothing to eat out there. I spent the whole second day hungry and terrified. I just waited for someone to come and save me. Then after that, just waiting for the sun to go down, waiting to be cold again. The snowmobile still wouldn't start. The engine had been flooded and was frozen solid as an ice cube. The sun went down again, and I was so frickin' terrified, just waiting for death to come. I really thought I wasn't going to make it. I started my second night, alone, freezing cold in the Labrador wilderness, only a snow cave for shelter. So, I'm laying there in my little cave of pine boughs and, well, I guess I should tell you this first. I never believed in the mummers when my family told me about them when I was a kid. Inuit spirits and legends, I didn't buy into them at all. They used to bug me for it. There was even a ceremony when they would pretend to beat up kids with sticks for not believing in spirits. So it was kind of a big deal that I didn't believe in those things. But either way, I didn't. Something must have stuck with me, though, because of how I reacted next. I heard what sounded like my mom and sister outside my hole in the snow. They were calling to me, telling me it was safe to come out now, that they had found me and I was being rescued. I heard that at first and was about to jump up and go running out of there. But then I stayed put, suddenly remembering the stories about the mummers. These creatures take on the voices of those closest to us and lure us away from safety, taking us with them into the cold ocean. They prey especially on children who stray too far from the safety of their parents. They take on their voices and lure them away by calling out to them in the voices of those most familiar to them. I didn't move, remembering that my uncle and my mother had told me. I stayed inside my little snow cave for the rest of the night, shivering, waiting for them to go away. But they kept calling to me, saying, "Andy, what are you doing? We're waiting for you out here. Why don't you come with us? We just want to take you back home." I stayed out there all night, and I didn't sleep for a long time as I listened to them call my name, coaxing and begging me to join them. When I woke up the next day, there was no one there. I was rescued later that same day by my uncle. My family believed what happened, saying now I couldn't doubt the legends any longer. But they told me never to speak of that day. I can't really remember why, though. I just finished typing this out. As I finished writing it, though, I heard a voice calling out to me from outside my living room window. It sounded like my mom, but what was she doing outside my apartment building at 2 a.m.? "Hey, Andy, can you come down here? It's really important." I stood on trembling legs and walked over to the glass. In the darkness below, I saw a figure, a woman, standing in the grass. She was soaking wet, long black hair hanging down and dripping, covering her face. "I don't think I'll sleep tonight," she calls out again and again. Maybe I shouldn't share this story, after all.